When you think about securing a high-value target, like a bank vault, the logic is usually pretty straightforward.
Right, you build a wall.
Exactly. You've got a thick steel door, maybe a laser grid, some guards stationed at choke points. It's completely binary. You're either inside the vault or you're outside the vault. It's this fixed, predictable perimeter that just doesn't change geometry while you're looking at it.
And that static nature is, well, it's what makes traditional defense comforting, right?
Totally.
The walls don't shift, the doorways don't suddenly relocate. You know exactly where the threat is coming from, and you can just anchor yourself to a spot and wait for them.
But okay, imagine if that vault was constantly moving around the building.
Sounds terrifying.
It is. And the thieves trying to break in are flying around at, 20 miles an hour on razor blades, passing this microscopic piece of explosive material between them. And oh yeah, your security guards have to simultaneously protect the gold, track the thieves, and figure out how to transport that gold out of the building while actively being attacked.
That is the most accurate anxiety-inducing description of defensive zone coverage in ice hockey I have ever heard.
Right?
It's just organized, high-speed, three-dimensional chaos.
And if you've ever watched a game and just screamed at your television because a guy was left completely wide open in front of your goalie, well, today's deep dive is for you.
It really is.
We're taking the definitive coaching manuals, the advanced analytics, and the incredibly dense rulebooks to completely decode how these defensive structures actually work.
Because there is a method to the madness.
Exactly. We're going to figure out the underlying architecture of why these systems exist, how to read the ice, and what to do when that carefully planned structure just completely disintegrates.
Which it always does.
Always.
The structure is really just a starting point, because you are dealing with this fundamental tension, this core paradox of playing defense in your own zone.
Okay, lay out the paradox for us.
Well, you only have five skaters. That's it. Five skaters and an ice surface that is mathematically not equally dangerous.
Right, because a shot from the blue line, like 55 feet away, is obviously not the same threat level as a shot from 2 feet away on the doorstep.
Precisely. So basic logic dictates that you have to pack the middle of the ice to prevent those high danger, close range goals, right?
Makes sense. Build a fortress.
But here is the paradox that just breaks coaches' brains. If you pack it too tight, if you put all five guys in a literal fortress around your goalie, you can never actually get the puck back.
Oh, because you're just standing there taking incoming fire.
Exactly. And even if a loose puck bounces to you, you have no one in a position to break out and transition to offense.
You win the puck, look up.
And you instantly give it right back to the other team because all your teammates are standing in the crease. So every single defensive system ever invented is really just a different flawed compromise between protecting the net and being ready to leave the zone.
Well, let's unpack that a bit, because if these are professional athletes or even just, super dedicated rec league players who are skating their absolute hearts out, why do these massive breakdowns happen so often?
That's a great question.
Because it feels like every single game, you see a guy standing all alone in the slot with enough time to write a novel before he shoots.
Right.
If everyone is trying so hard, is it just a lack of effort? Like, is somebody just being lazy?
That is the single biggest misconception in the sport. Most defensive zone breakdowns are not effort failures.
Really? Because fans always yell about effort.
Always. When a goal goes in from the slot, the immediate instinct on the bench or in the stands is to yell that someone didn't work hard enough, someone didn't back check.
Yeah.
But if you actually break down the film, almost always what happened was a communication failure.
A communication failure.
Yeah. You have two players who worked incredibly hard, pushing their physical limits, but they were operating on completely different assumptions about the system.
Oh, man.
So they skated as fast as they physically could in opposite, incorrect directions.
They're executing the wrong plan at 100% intensity,
Exactly.
which almost makes it worse because they are pulling themselves further out of position faster.
And that is why understanding the system is actually a tangible, physical hockey skill. It's not just theory.
It's applied knowledge.
Completely. A player who knows the structure perfectly and skates at, say, an 80% exertion level will consistently outdefend a player who doesn't understand the structure but skates at 100% effort. The game is just too fast to rely on chasing the puck.
So the mental model we need to build today starts with the ice itself.
Geography first.
Right. Before we talk about specific systems, we have to talk about the physical environment, because the geometry of the rink kind of dictates every single decision a coach makes.
It does. Let's define the most critical piece of geography in the sport. It's called the house.
The house, or sometimes you hear it called home plate, right?
Yeah, home plate is a great visual. Close your eyes and imagine the defensive zone.
Okay.
Start at the two goal posts on the goal line.
Got it.
Now draw a diagonal line outward from each post to the two face-off dots in the zone.
So we're widening out.
Exactly. From those dots, draw a straight line up to the top of the face-off circles. Finally, draw a horizontal line connecting those two top points straight across the high slot.
So if you look at that from a bird's eye view, it is literally a giant baseball home plate with the pointy end anchored right on your goaltender.
It is. Now, this isn't actually painted on the ice. It's an analytics convention, right? A mental boundary that defines the most important real estate in the game.
And the stats on this from our sources are wild.
Oh, they're staggering. To give you the hard data from the source material, 26.8% of all NHL goals are scored within just two stick lengths of the net.
Almost a third of the goals from just a few feet away.
Right. And 51.6%, more than half of all goals, are scored within 20 feet of the net. That entire cluster is inside the house.
So we aren't defending an entire zone. We're defending a very specific geometric shape painted invisibly in front of the net.
Yes.
A shot from inside the house is worth exponentially more than a shot from outside it.
Which means every single defensive system is just a different methodology for keeping five human bodies between that specific piece of ice and the puck.
Okay, so that brings us to the absolute laws of gravity in defensive hockey.
The non-negotiables.
Right. Regardless of what system your coach runs, regardless of whether you're playing in Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Final or playing at midnight on a Tuesday in a beer league, there are seven universal principles.
And you have to know all seven.
Let's deduce these.
Yeah.
Because if the house is that statistically dangerous, then law number one has to be about prioritization,
It
right?
does.
You have to defend the middle before you defend the outside.
That is law number one. If you are forced to choose between taking away a shot from the point way out of the blue line near the boards and taking away a pass into the slot, you always, without hesitation, take the pass.
You willfully concede the outside shot.
Every single time.
Because a shot from 55 feet through clean ice with no traffic is a save your goalie expects to make 100 times out of 100.
Exactly. But a pass across the slot to a guy waiting on the back door is almost an automatic goal. The human body, even an elite goalie's body, physically cannot move side to side faster than a hard pass.
Right.
So your job as a defender is to act as a funnel. You are constantly steering the puck carrier and the puck itself to the least dangerous areas of the ice.
You're kind of saying, I will let you shoot from the wall, but I will physically block you from entering the center.
That's the exact conversation you're having with your positioner.
That makes perfect sense on a whiteboard. But law number two is where human nature starts ruining the plan.
Oh, human nature is the enemy of defense?
Law number two is stay on the defensive side of the puck, which means just stand between the attacker and the net. But, I mean, I've played, I know that in practice, this is incredibly difficult to maintain. Why does our brain fight us on this?
Because human instinct makes you want to win the puck. You see the puck, you want to take it. But think about the biomechanics of skating.
Ugh.
When an attacker is skating past you and you reach out with your stick across your body to poke the puck, what happens to your core?
My shoulders rotate and my hips turn to follow my hands.
Right. And the exact millisecond your hips turn, you are no longer between the attacker and the net.
Oh, wow.
You are now standing beside them. And in a game played on ice, a half second of lateral momentum gives the attacker a full stride on you.
Because they're already moving
Yeah,
forward.
yes. You are officially on the wrong side of the puck. You're now just a guy skating behind the play, frantically waving your stick, defending absolutely nothing but open air.
So reaching for the puck is a trap.
A massive trap.
You have to move your feet to stay in the path rather than reaching out of the path.
Exactly. And that leads to the third universal law, which is arguably the cardinal sin of hockey defense. It is the most common cause of goals against at every single level of the sport.
Okay, what is it?
Law three. Never have both defensemen on the puck without explicitly knowing who has the goal mouth.
Oh, it's the toddler soccer phenomenon.
Yes, everyone just runs to the ball.
Right.
It is the high-speed equivalent of toddler soccer. Picture this. The puck gets dumped into the corner. One defenseman goes into the corner to engage the puck carrier.
Makes sense.
The other defenseman, seeing his partner locked in a battle, gets sucked in to help. It's a natural instinct to want to help your buddy.
Of course.
Now they are both in the corner fighting for one piece of rubber.
Meanwhile, a 220-pound opposing forward is casually skating to the front of the net, pulling up a chair, and waiting for a pass, completely unguarded.
Exactly. One simple pass out of the corner, and the entire defensive structure is obliterated. Two guys are stuck behind the goal line, and the goalie is left to face an execution squad.
Which perfectly sets up law number four.
Right. Somebody, and it doesn't matter who, but somebody must always have the goal mouth.
And the source material makes a really specific, almost pedantic distinction here.
Yeah.
It doesn't say somebody must have the slot. It says the goal mouth. What is the difference?
The slot is a large area between the face-off circles. It's dangerous, yes, but the goal mouth is the doorstep. It is the literal edge of the blue paint of the crease.
The highest of the high danger zones.
Yes. The player who is going to score the ugly, devastating, high percentage goal is standing with their stick on the ice right at the edge of that paint, waiting to tap in a rebound.
Right.
Depending on the system you play, the player responsible for standing there might be a defenseman, it might be a center, the identity changes, but the mathematical reality that someone must occupy that specific square foot of ice is completely non-negotiable.
Okay, law number five is about passing lanes. It's simply sticks flat on the ice. This feels like a cheat code for when you realize you've messed up law number two and you're out of position.
It is the ultimate recovery tool. If you have lost a step on a guy, your body mass is no longer blocking the lane to the net, but your stick is an extension of your radius.
Yeah.
An active stick lying flat on the ice in a passing lane takes away the cross-ice pass completely.
But wait, if my stick is just sitting flat on the ice, isn't it incredibly easy for a pro player to just saucer pass it over the blade or step around it?
You'd think so, but a saucer pass requires the attacker to change the angle of their blade, flip the puck, and land it flat for the receiver.
Which takes time.
It takes a fraction of a second longer, it's harder to execute under pressure, and it's much harder for the receiver to catch and shoot instantly. A flat stick forces them to make a difficult play instead of a simple flat tape-to-tape
And
pass.
if you're not doing that.
If you are just waving your stick around at hip height, which you see constantly in amateur hockey, it is doing absolutely nothing. Your legs might not be able to reach the puck carrier, but your flat stick can absolutely reach the lane they want to pass through.
Okay, that brings us to law number six. Box out at the net front.
The physical battle.
Right. The mechanics are inside, shoulder ahead, lift the stick up. Now, I want to really dig into this because this is where my instinct as a casual player completely clashes with the rule book.
Oh, I know where this is going.
Let's say a massive 6'4" forward is parked right in front of my goalie, completely screening his eyes.
Yeah.
Why can't I just take my stick, put it across his back, and shove him directly into my goaltender?
Oh, boy.
Like the net gets knocked off its moorings, the whistle blows, maybe there's a goalie interference call, the goal gets waved off, and problem solved. We reset.
Do not ever do that.
Never.
Never. That is a wildly common, incredibly dangerous, and completely wrong assumption that gets players penalized or ejected every day. Let's trace the actual rulebook applications across the governing bodies here, because the sources are remarkably unified in punishing this exact play.
Okay, let's hear it.
Shoving an attacker into your own goalie buys you absolutely nothing defensively.
How is that possible?
Yeah.
They physically crashed into the goalie? By definition, isn't that goaltender interference?
Not if you cause the crash.
Oh.
Under the NHL rulebook and International Ice Hockey Federation rules, if a defending player pushes an attacker into the goaltender and the referee determines the attacker made a, quote, reasonable effort to avoid the contact is not considered attacker initiated.
So they are innocent.
Yes. So if they get pushed in and the puck crosses the line, the goal stands. You just screened your own goalie, knocked him down, and gave up a good goal.
Wow. So the shove trick fails completely at the pro level. What about USA Hockey for amateur leagues? Is it any different?
Under USA Hockey, it is even worse because there isn't even a subjective, reasonable effort clause for the ref to debate.
It's just black and white.
Completely black and white. The rule clearly states that if a defender physically interferes with an attacker and forces them into the crease, any legal goal scored is allowed. You cannot manufacture an interference call by using your opponent as a bowling ball.
And what if we're playing under Hockey Canada rules?
Under Hockey Canada, you might actually take a penalty yourself.
Are you kidding?
Nope. Their interpretation of Rule 8.5 explicitly states the referee should penalize the defending player who committed the initial foul of pushing. So you give up the goal and you go to the penalty box.
That is a brutal double whammy.
And if we strip away the rules and just look at the practical reality, it is insanely dangerous.
Right, because of the goalie.
Exactly. You are forcefully shoving a 200-pound athlete backward onto your own goaltender. Goaltenders are usually down in a butterfly position, completely stretched out, and totally blind to the guy falling onto their neck or knees.
That's terrifying.
You are risking ending the career of the most important player on your team just to clear a sight line.
Consider that a massive red flag for anyone playing defense.
Yeah.
You have to move that screener with leverage and positioning, not by launching them into the blue paint.
Use your leverage, not your momentum.
Which brings us to the final foundation, law number seven, talk and talk early.
Communication. We established earlier that most breakdowns are communication failures.
Right.
But it's not just about making noise, it's about how you talk. The absolute golden rule of defensive communication is state your intentions, not your observations.
State intentions, not observations. Break that down for me in a game scenario.
Okay, you and your defensive partner are backing up into your zone. The other team is rushing towards you. If you yell, "He's coming down the left side," you are just making an observation.
Okay,
You
yeah.
are acting as a broadcaster. Your partner already knows the guy's coming down the left side. They have eyes. That observation helps a little, but it doesn't solve the structural problem of who is taking him.
So, what is the intention version of that?
I'm stepping up on the left. You take the middle.
Oh, that's clear.
That is an intention. It instantly resolves ambiguity. It tells your partner exactly what you are doing, which automatically dictates what they need to do to cover the space you are leaving.
So before we get into the complex systems,
Yeah.
what should we remember here? What's the mental checklist for surviving a shift?
Basically, funnel the puck out of the house, never abandon the blue paint to chase a corner battle, put your stick flat on the ice, and loudly announce what you are about to do.
If a team of five skaters just executed those principles without any complex coaching system layered on top, they would be an above-average defensive team.
Honestly, yes.
But coaches love their systems. So let's look at how we actually assign five players to protect that geometry. We begin with the absolute foundation, the low zone
The
collapse.
classic.
The source material calls this the house default. If you played minor hockey in North America, this is the first thing they taught you.
And they teach it first because it is conceptually simple. The core philosophy of a low zone collapse is that you are defending space, not people.
Okay, defending space.
Every player is assigned a specific quadrant of the defensive zone. If an opposing player skates into your quadrant, they are your responsibility.
And if they leave.
If they skate out of your quadrant, you do not follow them. You pass them off to your teammate and you stay anchored in your zone.
Let's visualize the shape. The other team has the puck deep in our right corner. We are setting up the low zone collapse. Where are five guys standing?
Think of the structure in two layers. Three players living low and two players living high.
Okay, starting low.
When the puck is in that strong side corner, meaning the side of the ice where the puck currently is, your strong side defenseman is in the corner actively battling the puck carrier.
That's one.
Your weak side defenseman, the one furthest from the puck, is parked firmly on the goal mouth, honoring law number four.
So that's two players. Where's the third low player?
Your center is the low support. They drop down below the face-off circles and enter the corner as a second body to help the strong side defenseman.
Ah, so you want to make it a two-on-one battle in the corner to win the puck back quickly.
Exactly. Overwhelm them on the strong side.
Okay, that covers the low layer. What about the high layer?
Your strong side winger is positioned high up near the blue line on the same side as the puck, staying between the opposing defenseman and the net. And your weak side winger is hovering near the far point, keeping an eye on the other opposing defenseman.
That is the static base shape.
Yes.
But the game isn't static.
Yeah.
The players aren't glued to those spots. When the puck moves, the system has to flex. And this brings us to what I think is the most brilliant mechanical feature of this entire system.
The trigger.
It's the moment the whole structure turns on.
Yeah.
The weak side wingers collapse. Let's trace the logic of this because it's beautiful.
It is the hinge upon which the entire system survives or dies. Picture the scenario we just built. The puck goes into the corner. The strong side defenseman engages. The center, who usually patrols the middle of the ice, leaves the slot to go into the corner and help win the puck.
And the millisecond that center leaves the middle of the ice, there is a giant gaping hole in the high slot.
Yes.
The most dangerous real estate in the house is suddenly completely empty.
Exactly. You
Yeah.
cannot leave the high slot empty.
Right.
It is prime real estate for a quick pass and a one-timer. So the system has an automatic trigger.
What's the trigger?
The instant the center drops below the face-off circles to help in the corner, the weak side winger, who is way up near the blue line on the opposite side of the ice, must drop off their point and sag down into the high slot.
They literally collapse into the space the center just evacuated.
Yes, they do.
It's like a bucket brigade.
Yeah.
One person steps out of the line to plug a leak, and the next person steps down to cover their spot, but only temporarily.
That's a perfect analogy.
Yeah.
And the instant the puck comes out of the corner or the center returns to the middle, that weak side winger climbs right back up to their point position.
Yeah.
They're constantly yo-yoing up and down based on where the center goes.
I see a mechanical flaw there, though. Or at least a question of efficiency.
Okay, what is it?
If the goal is to plug the hole in the flot as fast as possible, why doesn't the strong side winger drop down? They're much closer to the play. Why make the weak side guy skate all the way across the zone?
Because if the strong side winger drops down into the slot, they have completely abandoned the strong side blue line.
Oh.
The opposing defenseman standing there would be wide open. All the puck carrier in the corner has to do is slide the puck up the boards to that defenseman.
And then what?
If the winger has sagged into the slot, that defenseman now has a completely free, uncontested walk-in to the net. They can shoot, pass, or skate right down Broadway. By keeping the strong side winger high, you block the easiest escape valve for the puck carrier, forcing them to make a much harder cross-ice pass.
That spatial awareness is incredible. Everything is connected.
It's a web.
Now, let's look at the dark side of that corner battle we just mentioned. The center goes into the corner to make it a two-on-one.
Right.
When you arrive as the second man in a corner battle, the attacker who has the puck is usually facing the glass, digging the puck out of their skates. Their back is turned to the middle of the ice.
A very vulnerable position.
The source material spends an enormous amount of time going through the rule nuances here. Why is this specific interaction so heavily scrutinized?
Because it is the most common recipe for a catastrophic cervical spine injury in the sport.
Wow.
When you are the second man arriving, you are coming in hot. The puck carrier has their head down. They cannot see you coming. If you hit them square in the back, you are driving their head directly into the rigid boards.
That's horrifying.
It is. The rule here is foundational. Pin the puck, not the player.
But this isn't just a coaching cliche. The rule books have essentially criminalized hitting in this specific scenario.
They have codified it with extreme prejudice. Let's look at the breakdown, because the penalties escalate dramatically depending on where you play.
Start with the pros.
Under NHL and IIHF rules, if you check a player from behind into the boards, there is literally no minor penalty available to the referee.
Wait, really? There is no 2-minute minor tier at all?
None. The referee cannot show mercy even if they want to. The absolute floor for that infraction is an automatic major penalty, meaning your team is shorthanded for 5 full minutes and a game misconduct ejection.
You are done for the night instantly.
Instantly. Now, if we look at USA Hockey Rule 608, they do technically have a minor plus misconduct tier, which lets a player sit in the box for 12 minutes and eventually finish the game.
Oh, so there is some leniency there.
Well, hold on. Their official casebook basically slams that door shut for this exact scenario.
Really? How so?
The casebook demands that referees assess the major and game misconduct in almost every instance where a player forcefully checks an opponent who is standing on the boards with their back to the middle of the ice.
And a game misconduct in amateur leagues carries weight.
Right.
Oh, absolutely. Under USA Hockey, a game misconduct doesn't just end your night. It automatically suspends you for your team's next scheduled game. It is a massive deterrent.
And Hockey Canada.
Hockey Canada is equally militant here. Rule 7.5 specifically names this exact digging the puck out posture for strict enforcement.
So the takeaway for anyone playing a low zone collapse is,
when you go into that corner to support, you are using your stick to take the puck, or you are using your body to seal off the ice. You are never, under any circumstances, finishing a check into a vulnerable player's numbers.
Okay, so the low zone collapse protects the middle of the ice beautifully because you literally just have 5 bodies standing in it.
Right.
It's incredibly resilient against a team that just wants to cycle the puck along the boards.
Yeah.
So you just let them pass it around the outside while you conserve energy.
Yes.
But every system has a fatal flaw.
Yeah.
What does this system willingly concede?
It explicitly concedes put shots. By keeping your wingers relatively passive and sagging into the slot, you are allowing the opposing defenseman to shoot from 55 feet out.
You're just daring them to shoot.
You are placing a bet that your goaltender can stop a shot from that distance, even with traffic. But the real structural flaw, the Achilles heel that professional teams exploit to destroy the low zone collapse, is a tactic called the walkdown.
Trace the walk down for me. If I'm an opposing defenseman, how do I break your zone?
Imagine you are the attacking defenseman. You get the puck at the blue line, you look up, and you realize the defending winger isn't aggressively coming at you. They are just guarding their invisible zone boundary.
Right, because they're playing space, not man.
Exactly. So instead of winding up and shooting from 55 feet, you simply put your head up and skate forward. You skate right past the blue line, past the top of the circles, aiming straight for the faceoff dot.
And the defending winger doesn't stop me.
The defending winger, adhering strictly to their zone rules, might shadow you for a stride or two, but eventually you cross the imaginary line out of their designated quadrant.
Yeah, and they just let me go.
They stop. And suddenly, you've just walked down to 35 feet from the goal line, completely untouched. You have half the distance to the net.
Oh, wow.
You now have an incredibly dangerous scoring chance, and you've forced a low defender to panic and leave the net front to come stop you. The zone has completely unraveled.
So if the low zone collapse leaves a team that vulnerable to a skilled puck-moving defenseman just walking down the ice, how do teams counter it?
You have to change the philosophy.
Right. This takes us to the fix. If defending space fails, teams abandon space entirely, and they start tracking bodies. Enter man-on-man coverage.
Pure man-on-man is exactly what it sounds like, and it fundamentally changes the geography of the defense. Everyone on the ice is assigned a specific opposing player, and you follow them everywhere they go.
Okay, let's sign them.
The two defensemen take the low attacking forwards, the center takes the high attacking forward, and here is the massive paradigm shift.
Mm.
The wingers are assigned to mark the opposing defensemen, and they shadow them across the entire sheet of ice.
Everywhere. Like if the attacking defenseman decides to skate all the way down to the corner flag, my winger goes with him.
All the way to the corner flag, behind the net, wherever. This is the sharpest practical difference from the zone collapse.
So the walk down is dead.
If that attacking defenseman tries to execute the walk down we just discussed, your winger is glued to their hip the entire way down the ice. The walk down ceases to exist as an offensive threat. In pure man-on-man, nobody is ever open in the seams because the concept of unmarked space is not a state that exists. You are a blanket on a body.
I see the immediate appeal of that. It sounds completely airtight. If I'm touching my guy, he can't score.
That's the theory.
So why isn't this the ultimate unbeatable system that every single team runs?
Because the cascading failure of man-on-man is absolutely catastrophic.
Catastrophic.
Yes. It is structurally rigid, but incredibly fragile in practice.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at the three major flaws. First, it is physiologically exhausting.
Oh, because of the chasing.
Exactly. In a zone system, if the puck moves, you might just pivot in place. In man-on-man, if your assigned player decides to skate laps around the zone for 45 seconds, you have to sprint with them for 45 seconds, reacting to their movements. You are playing at their dictated pace in your own zone.
You burn your legs out just playing defense.
You're exhausted before you even get the puck back. Second, it is highly vulnerable to picks or screens.
Like a pick and roll in basketball.
Exactly like basketball, but much faster and on ice. If the attacking team realizes you are playing strict man-to-man, they will intentionally run crisscross patterns. They will subtly run the player you are chasing right past another attacker.
And you just crash into them.
You get caught up in the traffic, you get rubbed out of the play, and suddenly your man has a two-stride lead to the net. And because everyone else on your team is glued to their own man, there is absolutely no help coming. If one guy gets beat, the whole system shatters.
Total collapse from one tiny error. What's the third flaw?
It creates brutal, unavoidable mismatches.
Like size or speed?
Speed, mostly. Let's say you have a slow, bruising fourth-line winger. The other team has a lightning-fast, highly skilled, puck-moving defenseman.
Oh, no.
If that defenseman realizes your slow winger is locked onto him, he will just skate away from the blue line, drag your winger into open ice, and easily beat him in a foot race. You are forcing your worst skaters to play one-on-one against elite athletes.
That's a nightmare.
And finally, even if you survive all of that, when you actually do win the puck back, your players are scattered randomly all over the ice based on where the attackers drag them. You have no structure. Your breakout readiness is effectively zero.
So zone coverage gets slowly dismantled by the walk down. Pure man-on-man is exhausting and shatters if one person loses a foot race.
Mm.
What is the solution? Where do professional coaches land?
They land on the pro standard, The hybrid system.
The hybrid.
This is what the coaching certain materials routinely describe as the most common arrangement in modern professional hockey. It attempts to marry the structural stability of the zone with the aggressive denial of man-on-man.
Let's trace the mechanics of the hybrid. How does it split the ice?
It splits the defensive zone in half horizontally. Below the face-off dots, deep in your zone where the danger is highest, you play strict man-on-man.
Okay.
Above the face-off dots, up near the blue line, you play zone coverage.
Best of both worlds. Down low, you give them no space to breathe. Up high, you save energy and hold your defensive shape.
Exactly. Down low, your defensemen and your center lock onto their assigned forwards. No free space, heavy pressure. Up high, your wingers play area coverage, guarding the points but not chasing.
But how does it handle the walk down?
This is the critical trigger that makes the hybrid system work. The instant that an opposing defenseman skates forward and crosses the face-off dots or the hash marks, depending on where your specific coach draws the imaginary line, that defenseman transitions from being in a zone to being a man.
So the winger's playing zone, but the moment the defenseman tries the walk down and crosses the dots, the winger says, "Okay, now you're my guy," and latches onto him.
Precisely. It perfectly neutralizes the walk-down threat while keeping the wingers high enough to instantly start a breakout pass the moment you win the puck back.
It sounds flawless on paper.
Mm-hmm.
Where does the hybrid break down in reality?
It requires absolutely flawless, constant communication because that imaginary line, the dots, is just that, imaginary.
Yeah.
If your winger and your center disagree in real time on exactly whether a player is below the dots or above the dots, a massive hole opens up.
Because one guy thinks it's a zone and one guy thinks it's a man.
Exactly. The center might think he's still high, the winger has him. The winger might think he crossed the line, he's the center's guy now. Two players operating on different sides of that question is the exact recipe for a wide open slot and a goal against.
So before we jump to the alternative systems, let's do a quick retrieval review.
Good idea.
If I'm a listener sitting in the upper bowl with a hot dog tonight, watching my team get hemmed in their own zone, what is the one cheat code I can look for to figure out which of these three systems they are actually trying and failing to run?
I love this because it completely changes how you watch the sport. Don't watch the puck.
Don't watch the puck.
Watch what happens when the puck goes deep into the corner. Specifically, lock your eyes on the weak side winger, the forward, who is all the way up high on the opposite side of the ice from the puck. Ask yourself, what does that player do?
Okay, what are the options?
Do they stay high and sag gracefully into the middle of the high slot? If yes, the team is playing a zone collapse.
And if they don't?
If you see that weak side winger suddenly abandon the blue line entirely, skate all the way across the ice, and chase a body down low into the corner or behind the net, the team is playing man-on-man or a hybrid.
Wow.
You can identify an NHL team's entire defensive philosophy in about 4 seconds just by watching one winger.
That is a phenomenal tool for any hockey fan.
Mm.
Now, sometimes the standard systems just aren't right. Maybe the skill level of the players is much lower, or the game situation is desperate and you need extreme measures.
Yeah.
Let's look at the alternative shapes. The source material highlights one specifically for beginners and rec leagues called the Box Plus One.
The Box Plus One is visually exactly what it sounds like. Four players form a tight box around the slot. Two players are stationed low near the goalposts, and two players are stationed high at the tops of the face-off circles, which is about 29 feet below the blue line.
Okay, so that forms the box.
That forms the box. The fifth player, the plus one, acts as a rover and aggressively chases the puck wherever it goes.
If I'm watching that, it looks exactly like a penalty kill formation.
It looks very similar to a standard PK box. But a penalty kill only has four players on the ice total. The box plus one is an even strength system with five players.
How does it rotate?
The unique mechanic is that when the puck moves from one side of the ice to the other, the plus one roll passes to whoever is closest to it, and the box rotates seamlessly to fill the spot that player just vacated.
Why would anyone use this? It seems incredibly passive compared to the hybrid.
It is extremely passive.
Yeah.
But it is used heavily in youth hockey and adult rec leagues because it is incredibly forgiving of individual mistakes.
Because there's always a box backing you up.
Exactly. It completely short circuits the classic beer league phenomenon where all five players panic and chase one puck into the corner. It forces structure.
But what's the downside?
What it concedes is massive. It concedes the entire perimeter of the ice. A highly skilled puck-moving team will just hold the puck forever, passing it around the outside of your box for 2 minutes until someone in the box gets bored, steps out of position, and opens a passing lane.
The next alternative shape is the collapsing box. How is that different?
The collapsing box is not really a system you intentionally play for a full 60 minutes. It is a state of emergency.
A panic button.
Exactly. It's what the low zone collapse turns into under maximum pressure. All five of your players pack tightly inside the house, shoulder to shoulder, completely abandoning the points, abandoning the boards, and just building a human wall in front of the net.
When do you deploy the panic room?
Late in a game, when you are protecting a one-goal lead, and you know that giving up a point shot costs you nothing, but allowing a cross-ice backdoor pass costs you the game. You also use it when defending a 6-on-5 situation when the other team pulls their goalie for an extra attacker.
Or when everyone is just totally gassed.
Oh, frankly, yes. When your structural system has totally fallen apart, everyone is exhausted, and you just need to survive 10 more seconds until a whistle.
And the absolute polar opposite of that emergency turtle state is the strong side overload.
Right. Instead of collapsing passively to the middle, the strong side overload is hyper-aggressive. All five of your defenders shift heavily to the puck side of the ice, literally cutting the rink in half.
What's the goal there?
You are trying to squeeze the puck carrier to death against the boards, take away all of their time and physical space, and force an immediate turnover.
But the spatial vulnerability there has to be massive. If I have five guys on the left side of the ice, what is happening on the right?
Absolutely nothing, which is the problem. It absolutely dies to one hard, accurate, cross-ice pass to the back door because, by design, you have left the entire weak side of the ice completely empty.
That's a huge gamble.
It is a high-risk, high-reward gamble. If the attacker can absorb the pressure and flip a pass across the zone, it is an automatic empty net goal.
So we've built this beautiful, pristine architecture of systems. We know the geography, we know the rules, we know the shapes. But opposing offenses know exactly how these systems work, and their entire goal is to break them.
Right, they're actively hunting for the flaws.
How do we apply this knowledge dynamically against the specific offensive weapons teams will throw at us? Let's start with the most common tactic, the cycle.
The cycle is an offensive tactic where attackers rotate continuously along the boards, passing the puck deep, retrieving it, and passing it back up the wall to a teammate arriving in the space they just vacated.
It was like a washing machine.
That's exactly it. The psychological goal of the cycle is to make your defense dizzy, to make you impatient, and to force you to chase the puck until someone gets pulled out of position.
If I'm trapped in the washing machine, what's my strategy?
You refuse to chase. You defend the exit points of the cycle, not the puck itself.
Explain that.
Let them stay on the perimeter all night and waste their energy if they want to. The most valuable place to break a cycle is by physically cutting off a puck carrier who is trying to turn the corner and come out from below the goal line to the front of the net. You meet them at the goalpost, you establish body position, and you stop the rotation.
Offensive threat number two, the low to high play. The offense intentionally pushes the puck deep to draw the defense low, and then they zip a quick pass all the way up to the point for a slap shot through traffic.
This play is mathematically designed to punish the low zone collapse.
Because the weak side winger is sagging.
Yes. The entire defensive strategy against this rests squarely on the shoulders of the strong side winger. If that winger lacks discipline and gets sucked down low into the corner battle to watch the puck, the point is left wide open and the low to high pass becomes devastating.
So they have to stay disciplined.
That winger must stay high, hovering in the passing lane. And critically, when the pass does go up to the point, they have to close out aggressively on the shooter at the top of the circle.
Not just stand there.
You cannot just stand statically at the hash marks and wave your stick. You have to skate through the shooting lane to block it.
Threat number three, the point shot with a screen. We talked about this a bit earlier when I asked about shoving the guy, but I want to get deeper into the physical mechanics of this.
Okay.
If I can't shove the 220-pound forward into the goalie and I'm playing in a beer league where open ice body checking isn't allowed, how on earth do I actually move this massive human being?
You have to establish position early and hold it with leverage. And the rule books are fascinatingly specific here about the line between a legal battle for position and a penalty.
What's the line?
Walking a player backward by putting leverage under their arms or on their hips is basically only legal in full checking leagues.
Wait, really? Pushing a guy out of the crease with your body is illegal in non-checking leagues?
Yes, and this catches so many amateur players off guard. In non-checking leagues, under USA Hockey Rule 604C and Hockey Canada Rule 7.3A, pushing an opponent off a spot of ice that they've already legally established is considered a body-checking penalty.
Wow.
And the referee's leniency vanishes instantly if it goes wrong. If you push a screener and they lose an edge and fall awkwardly into the goalpost and get injured, Hockey Canada makes a major penalty and a game misconduct mandatory.
There's no referee discretion.
There is no referee discretion. You are ejected.
So physical displacement is a total minefield. What is the alternative? How do I neutralize the screen if I can't move the body?
You target the highest value asset, the stick, the stick lift.
The stick lift.
A giant screener with a free stick resting on the ice is a tip-in or a deflection waiting to happen. A giant screener whose stick is lifted 2 feet in the air is just a large, harmless obstacle that your goalie can easily look around.
But the technique of the stick lift is crucial, right? I can't just hack at his arms.
You absolutely cannot chop down. A lumberjack chop at the hands or the stick from the top is a slashing major across almost all rule books, including the NHL. It breaks sticks and it breaks fingers.
So how do you do it?
The correct technique is to slide the blade of your stick underneath theirs and lift up, making contact just below their bottom hand. If you cleanly lift the stick from underneath, taking it completely off the ice, you neutralize the scoring threat without taking a penalty. You render them useless.
Which brings us to the final, most terrifying threat, the back door, or the weak side seam pass. The source material explicitly calls this the most dangerous play in hockey.
Because it exploits human nature. While everyone in the arena, the fans, the goalie, and four of the defenders are intensely watching the puck battle on the strong side boards, one clever attacker silently drifts away from the play to the far goalposts.
Just sneaks away.
One hard, flat cross ice pass through the seam, and the shooter has a completely open net before the goalie can even pivot.
How do you defend a ghost?
The weak side defensemen must physically discipline themselves to watch the man, not the puck. If you are standing in front of the net and your chest is facing the corner where the puck is, you have already lost your man. You have to keep your head on a swivel.
So you track the body with your eyes, and then what?
You lay your stick completely flat on the ice across the slot, bisecting the passing seam. Even if the passer sees the open man, a flat stick makes the cross ice pass nearly impossible to thread. And finally, you must communicate early. You yell back door or ghost the absolute second the attacker arrives in the space, not when the puck is already in the air.
Everything we've discussed so far assumes that the system is functioning. It assumes some level of control. But what happens when the shot gets through? A weird rebound pops out off the goalie's pad, and it is absolute utter chaos in the crease.
The statistics tell the story of why this is so terrifying. 11.4% of all NHL goals happen within 3 seconds of a previous shot.
That's a huge percentage.
Scrambles are incredibly dangerous because structure vanishes instantly. Your first priority in a net front scramble is body first, puck second. You must physically tie up the most dangerous opposing stick before you even attempt to look for where the puck went.
That feels completely counterintuitive. As a defender, my brain is screaming at me to find the puck and clear it.
I know, but think about the timeline. If you are spinning around looking for a black piece of rubber in a sea of skates, and the attacker standing next to you has a free stick, the moment the puck pops out, they will swat it into the net before your eyes even focus on it. You have to tie up the weapon first.
Okay, stick tied up. What's the second rule of the scramble?
Stay on your feet, diving headfirst into a pile of swinging composite sticks and razor-sharp skate blades is a terrible, dangerous idea.
But players want to block the shot.
Players think they are being heroic by laying out, but USA Hockey's slashing rules offer absolutely no attempt to play the puck leniency. If an opponent is swinging at a loose puck and their stick comes down on your exposed hand in a scramble, it's a major penalty for them, yes, but your hand is still broken. Use your stick, use your reach, but stay on your feet.
Let me throw a very specific, desperate scenario at you.
Bring it.
The puck hits the goalie's shoulder and pops straight up into the air in the crease. It is fluttering down, about to drop directly behind the goalie into the net. I'm a defenseman. I panic. I reach out. I catch the puck out of the air with my leather glove, and I immediately drop it outside the crease. Was that a good play?
Surprisingly, yes. In three of the four major rule books, the NHL, IIHF, and Hockey Canada, catching the puck out of the air is perfectly legal, provided that you drop it immediately to the ice. USA Hockey doesn't print this explicit permission in their main rulebook text, but their official casebook does allow it if it is one fluid, continuous motion.
But there's a trap here, isn't there? The panic makes you do dumb things.
There is a massive trap, and it costs teams championships. What penalizes you is what you do next.
Okay, what can't I do?
If you catch that puck out of the air and you close your hand to hold it, or you take a skating stride with it, or you turn your body to shield it from an attacker, or you try to throw it away into the corner.
Basically any hockey move.
Yes. If you do any of those secondary actions while the puck is inside your own goal crease, the referee will immediately point to center ice. It is an automatic penalty shot for the other team.
You save a goal, but you immediately give them a one-on-one with your goalie.
And it gets worse. If your team happens to have pulled your goalie for an extra attacker and the net is empty, doing that results in an automatically awarded goal. You don't even get a penalty shot. The other team just gets a point on the board.
So the rule of thumb is swat it, knock it down like a volleyball, but whatever you do, do not close your hand and hold onto it while standing in the blue paint.
Exactly. And keep in mind, the geometry of the crease is three-dimensional. It is a volume of space. It extends vertically 4 feet from the surface of the ice up to the exact height of the crossbar.
I didn't realize it went up.
It does. If you catch the puck above the crossbar, you are outside the technical crease, and it's just a standard 2-minute minor penalty for closing your hand on the puck. But if you catch it knee-high in the paint and turn your shoulders with it, that's the penalty shot. The vertical height dictates the severity of the call, but the physical action of holding it is always an infraction.
Which perfectly transitions us to the final phase, chaos management and the zone exit. Eventually, no matter how good you are, the structure completely collapses. The system breaks. When that happens, how do we survive the next 10 seconds, and how do we correctly exit the zone without instantly giving the puck back? Walk me through the triage list.
When the system breaks and everyone is scrambling, you follow this mental hierarchy strictly in order. One, get bodies to the net front immediately. Protect the house.
Protect the house.
Two, put sticks flat on the ice in any visible passing lanes. Three, stop staring at the puck carrier. Find the most dangerous, unmarked player. The guy without the puck who is drifting into the slot is the one who is going to score.
Find the coast.
Four, count heads and match up out loud. Literally yell, "I've got 19 to eliminate confusion. Five, get the puck out of the zone any way you legally can.
I want to highlight the golden rule embedded in that triage.
Thanks.
Because I absolutely love the logic of it. If you are totally lost, if you have just been spun around, you have no idea what system you're currently in or who you should be covering. Just skate to the middle of the ice.
Yes.
A mistake made inside the house is a much smaller, more survivable mistake than a mistake made outside it.
Yes.
If you are going to be wrong standing in front of your own net, blocking a lane with your body.
Exactly. Survive the chaos first. But eventually, you will win a puck battle. And when you do, you have to execute the zone exit. The single biggest mechanical mistake amateur defensemen make is retrieving a loose puck out of the corner, digging it out, and then looking up to see what they should do with it.
By the time they look up, a forechecker is already cross-checking them into the glass.
Exactly. You have to scan the ice before you touch the puck. While the physical battle is still happening, while you are skating toward the loose puck, you should be checking over your shoulders to see where your teammates are and where the pressure is coming from. You decide your exit route before the puck is even on your stick.
And there's a clear hierarchy for those exit routes, too.
Right. Option number one is always the controlled exit. You make a crisp pass to a winger who is actively skating down the boards toward the hash marks to support you. You do not pass to a winger who is just standing statically at the blue line waiting for a 90-foot home run pass.
What if option one isn't there?
Option number two, if the pass isn't there, is a rim or a chip. It's an uncontrolled exit, but it's safe. You fire the puck hard around the glass or chip it high into the neutral zone. You don't keep possession, but you survive, the pressure ends, and you can get a line change.
And option three?
And option three is just anything that ends the shift without a goal.
But there are strict rules that restrict how you can clear it. If I'm panicking, I'm exhausted, and I just fire the puck out of the rink, over the plexiglass, into the netting, that's a penalty, right?
In the NHL and IIHF, yes, it is severely punished. Shooting the puck directly out of play from inside your own defensive zone is an automatic 2-minute delay of game minor.
No exceptions.
There are tiny specific carve-outs if the puck deflects off the glass first, or if it happens to go directly into the player's bench where there is no glass, but generally it's an automatic penalty. Interestingly, USA Hockey and Hockey Canada are much more forgiving.
Oh, really?
They only penalize deliberate shootouts. If a kid just accidentally flubs a clearing attempt over the glass, it's just a whistle and a face-off, no penalty.
What about icing? If I'm trapped and I just hammer the puck all the way down to the other end of the ice to relieve the pressure?
Icing brings the puck all the way back to your defensive zone for a face-off, and the brutal tactical punishment in the NHL and IIHF is that the tired defensive line that iced the puck is legally prohibited from changing.
Oh, that's torturous.
You have to stay out on the ice, lungs burning, exhausted, for a high-pressure defensive zone face-off. The only exception the referees will allow is for a genuine visible injury.
But it's different in grassroots hockey.
Yes. Under Hockey Canada, for example, below the U18 AAA elite level, you actually can change lines freely after an icing. The rulebook recognizes that exhausting amateur players isn't safe or productive. It's a huge difference in how the flow of the game is managed at the local rink versus the professional arenas.
And there's one more clearing restriction we have to touch on, the goalie. Sometimes, to help clear the puck, the goalie will skate out of the crease into the corner to stop a rimmed puck.
They can only do that in highly restricted geographic areas. In the NHL and IIHF, the goalie is physically prohibited from playing the puck in the corners outside the painted trapezoid behind the net. If they touch the puck in those restricted corners, it's an automatic penalty.
Yeah, and the other leagues.
USA Hockey and Hockey Canada don't paint a trapezoid on the ice, but they still heavily restrict a goalie from skating way out into the corner and just falling on the puck to freeze it and force a whistle.
Okay, we have covered an absolutely incredible amount of ground today. We've gone from the geography of the rink to the laws of defense, through three different structural systems, and deep into the rulebook minutiae of crease scrambles. Let's crystallize this.
Let's do it.
Let's build that final mental framework. If a listener is going to take only the absolute highest value concepts to the rink with them, what are we bouncing back and forth here?
I'll start with the foundation, the geography. Defend the house before you defend the outside. Concede the 55-foot shot to take away the 10-foot pass. Every single system is built on that premise.
I like the cheat code. If you want to understand any team's system instantly, just watch their weak side winger. If that winger sags into the high slot, they are playing a zone collapse. If that winger chases a defenseman down into the corner, they are playing man-on-man or a hybrid.
Exactly. And speaking of the corners, remember the physical rules of engagement. Pin the puck, not the player. Arriving forcefully into a vulnerable player's back while they are digging for a puck isn't just bad form, it is a guaranteed major penalty, an ejection, and a potential suspension, depending on your league.
The crease chaos rule. You can catch a fluttering puck in the crease to save a goal, but the exact second you close your hand to hold it or you turn your body, you have handed the other team a penalty shot. Knock it down, don't hold it.
And finally, the scanning principle. You must look over your shoulder and scan the ice before you retrieve a loose puck. You need to know your exit route, whether it's a pass to a low winger or a hard rim around the glass before the puck ever touches your stick.
That is the complete defensive masterclass. But I want to leave you, the listener, with one final provocative thought to mull over as we wrap up. We have spent this entire deep dive talking about how to defend the house when the opponent has the puck. But think about how these exact same rules, systems, and vulnerabilities apply when you are the one on offense.
Oh, that is an excellent flip of the script. The defensive structure is the offense's blueprint.
Exactly. If you are on offense and you recognize in 4 seconds that the defending team is playing a strict low zone collapse, you now know exactly where their blind spots are.
You know the top of the circles are yours.
Yes, because their wingers are sagging. You know that if you initiate a washing machine cycle down low, their weak side winger is going to drop, artificially opening up the far point for a massive cross-ice pass.
Once you can see the matrix of the defensive structure, the offensive solutions present themselves almost automatically. You aren't just reacting anymore. You are exploiting their specific geometry.
If you know the blueprint of the vault, you know exactly how to crack it. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Take these mental models, take this gritty rulebook reality, and bring it to the rink. Whether you are watching from the upper bowl with a hot dog or lacing up your skates for a late-night shift, you are no longer just watching high-speed chaos. You are seeing the system. We'll see you next time.